Get very practical and talk about how being a Christian, specifically our hope in the gospel, our Christian faith, makes a different, plays itself out in various aspects of our life that sometimes we don't think it does. And just by way of reminder, the gap that we're talking about is the problem that many Christians have, where we see the Christian faith as being relevant to our past. You know, it's good news that Jesus died a long time ago, and so my sins are forgiven, and so the gospel's good news for my past. And I know it's good news for my future. I know that when I die, I'll get to go to heaven, and so that's good news. But as far as the day in and day out, just dealing with the pressures of life, the anxieties of work and loss and difficulty, we're not really taking the faith and applying it to those things, and so we don't experience the growth that we should and the fruit that we often should, because there's a gap. And other things begin to fill that gap. If the gospel's not there, something else will. I'm not going to get into that. If you want to hear that, I will put our last week's class up online sometime this week, as well as this week's class. And so that was the introduction. This week we're going to get into, start going through our list, and we're going to start here with basically the gospel and my work, or the gospel and my vocation. And hopefully this is not just, this is broader than those of us who work a 9-to-5 job, because all of us will see have a vocation that God has given us, whether or not you're actively working outside the home or not. It certainly applies to that. But even if you're not, this is still very applicable stuff. Why talk about this? Well, because most of us, except for the few of us like myself who happen to be in vocational ministry kind of as a full-time employment, full-time calling, most of us spend most of our waking hours working in some non-religious capacity. You know, you're not working for a church, and that is what I mean by that. So you're not working for a full-time ministry. We spend, one writer said, you know, if you estimate 40 hours a week for 40 years or more, that's more than 80,000 hours you spend doing whatever your vocation happens to be, what God has called you to do. So that's a lot of time. And for most of us, it's actually more than that, because it's more than 40 hours a week and more than 40 years. And again, most of us, you know, that work is not just somehow, it's not directly related to the kingdom of God in the sense of you're preaching, you're teaching, you're evangelizing, you're doing some parachurch ministry. For most people, that's not the case. Most Christians, that's not the case. So it is a relevant question. How does my faith, how does the gospel, my identity as a Christian, shape the way I think and carry out the primary calling that God has given me, at least in this season of life? So that's what we're going to talk about today. Let's start with a kind of a brief, very brief, biblical theology of work. And by that I mean just thinking of work in the place of God's creation in our life. Work, when was work instituted? Maybe we'll start that. When do we find people working in the Bible for the first time? That's right, the Garden of Eden. God created man, and then he gave Adam and Eve a job to do, to, you know, work the garden and keep it. And so because of that, theologians will talk of work as a creation ordinance. Right? In other words, work is not something that came in after the fall. You know, work is not a result of sin per se. Well, you sin, now you got to work. Before, you could have, you know, laid on the beach all day in the Garden of Eden and done nothing, right? We might think that. We might think work is a result of sin, but it's not. Work is inherently good. It's part of our DNA, so to speak, part of being made in the image of God. God works, right? God worked for 6 days and then he rested, and we're made in his image. And so it's not surprising to find man being given, you know, humanity being given the task as the image of God to work and then rest. And so work is actually inherently good. It's a creation ordinance given to man as part of what it means to reflect God's image. Now, just, this is a bit of a side note, but I'll ask since we're talking about this. Does anyone know what are the other two creation ordinances besides work that come out of Genesis 1 through 3?
Go forth and multiply.
Worship.
be fruitful and multiply. So I guess we'd say marriage. Entwined with that. Yeah. So marriage is one of them. You know, marriage is a creation ordinance. It's not something that's uniquely Christian. It's not something that's a result of the fall per se. It's part of, you know, man being man's part of our makeup as the image of God. Other one, anyone with the other one? Worship, Fred? Yeah, I mean, theologians will say the Sabbath. And I won't get into this. We spent a lot of time on this at the last studies in theology. But, you know, God in the garden, part of man being man was that they observed a rest one day in seven. Because that was the pattern that God had set. And that's a key, again, this would get us way off topic, but that's one of the key arguments for Reformed theologians that God still requires us as people, as humans, to give him one day in seven. Because it's not something unique to Israel. It's not something that went away with the coming of Christ. Because part of God's creation of Adam and Eve in the garden was follow my pattern of rest. I worked and then rested one. And so our own confession says that one day in seven principle is a creation ordinance. It's applicable on all, you know, for all people of all times. We owe God one day in seven by design. That's part of what it means to be human. Anyway, so those are the three creation ordinances. Work is one of them. So work is inherently good, but of course, like everything else, our work has been corrupted or marred by the fall into sin. That was part of the curse, right, that God gave to Adam. You know, you'll labor, but now you're going to have thorns and thistles, and work is going to be frustrating. And of course, that explains to one degree why or another why, no matter what we do, all of our work will, to some degree or another, is marked by frustration, lack of fulfillment, discouragement, those types of things. I mean, that really is part of living in a fallen world. Work is not as good as it was created to be anymore. Our sin has affected our capacities for enjoyment and the degree of fruitfulness we have. So that's point two as far as the biblical theology. Work is inherently good. Our work has been marred by the fall. It's been affected by sin. The last point we'll make here by way of introduction is that even in a fallen world, all of our works is still important and still matters to God. And so the fall affects our work, but it doesn't mean it's meaningless. It doesn't mean that it's not worth doing. It still is important to God. How we carry it out matters, and it's a way, as we'll see, that we actually can love our neighbors. So even in a fallen world, and I would say particularly for Christians, the way we engage our work, our vocations, still matters to God. Okay, so that's just a quick overview of work. Any thoughts or questions at this point? All right, we'll press on then. I want to talk a little bit, again, we are going to get very practical about this, but it's important that we talk a little bit about the whole idea of vocation, the doctrine of vocation. That word vocation, we use that just means calling, basically. It's from a Latin word. And the reason we need to talk about this is because the Protestant Reformation, of course, which is our heritage, Luther and Calvin and all those guys, really did, in a way, rediscover the importance of vocation, of work outside of kind of full-time ministry, if I can put it that way. We have to remember that medieval Catholicism at the time of the Reformation taught, and I don't know exactly if they've changed their stance on this or not, but basically that you had to be really holy, to really be doing the work of the Lord. You can't really be engaged in kind of secular work. You know, you need to take vows of poverty and chastity. And so, of course, that rules out any kind of family life. That just distracts you from the work of the Lord. It's not that that's wrong, but that keeps you from actually, you know, going up, you know, the chain of spirituality in a way. Vows of poverty, celibacy, and of course the ideal then was to be a monk or a nun. That was the spirit. If you really want to serve God, this is what you do. You separate yourself from the world, from any kind of normal work. You know, you don't go be a farmer, you don't go be a mechanic. You really want to serve God, be a monk. Take these vows and, you know, have the life of prayer and the life where you basically spend all the time by yourself and with your other monks, prayer and worship. That's the only thing you do. And so in that, it basically did denigrate the so-called secular lifestyles of marriage, parenthood, and economic activity. Any of the regular jobs that other people have were a lesser calling. You see what I'm saying? And so there was not a high view, we could say, of work, of vocation in the medieval Roman Catholic Church because of that. Now, the Protestant Reformation changed that. Luther, of course, was one of the ones that did most of the pioneering work on this. And we've probably shared that story. And I think this is historically accurate, although I came across something the other day that questioned if Luther said it, at least in this exact form. Maybe Brett has something to comment on that. If you do, please do. But, you know, the story of Luther, after the Reformation had started, several of the, like Luther himself was a priest, right? A Roman Catholic priest. First a monk and then a priest. And several of the monks and priests were converted to the Reformation, left the monasteries, and there's a story of one guy coming to Luther saying, well, what do I do now? You know, I have devoted my life to this. You know, Luther was pretty hard on monks and the priesthood. I should have brought you some quotes from his writings, but of course he was in it, and so he did it. It's one of those things, you probably have a right to speak against the class that you were in, but he did not have a high opinion of that type of lifestyle. He really didn't think there was a way you could waste your life more than being a monk, where you kind of separate yourself from the world and just pray all day and do that. I should have brought you some, maybe I'll bring you some quotes next week, but because he was pretty, he could be pretty nasty. You know, Luther was known for that. Definitely had a wit, and got fired up. Anyway, so this priest comes to Luther and says, "Well, what should I do now? You know, I'd given my life over to this. You're telling me that this doesn't, you know, this is not the way I should spend my life." And he said, "Well, what did you do before you were a priest?" And he said, "Well, I was a shoemaker." And he said, "Well, then go make shoes and sell them at a fair price. Honor God that way." You know, and so, I mean, it's a short little snippet, but shows that the Protestant Reformation restored the dignity of being a shoemaker. You don't have to take vows and be full-time into some sort of religious service to honor God or to do spiritual service in a way. We'll talk more about that. The Reformers emphasize, again, particularly Luther, the spiritual dimensions of regular family life, of productive labor, of cultural engagement. As I said, vocation is simply a word which means calling. And according to Luther, God calls all of us to various tasks and relationships. We have vocations in our family. You know, all of us, or not all of us, but many of us are called right now to be husbands and wives and parents. That's actually a vocation. That's a calling that God gives us. God gives us vocations in the workplace, you know, whatever our job happens to be, whether we're bosses or employees. God calls us to vocations in culture as citizens or as politicians or those, you know, people in Washington that help make laws. We also have vocations in the church, you know, pastors, elders, pianists, congregants. But the spiritual life is not to be lived out mainly in church and church activity. See, this is where the Reformation made a sharp break. Rather, when we come to church, we find the preaching of forgiveness for the sins we've committed during our vocations, in our various vocations. Then through word and sacrament, our faith is strengthened. Our faith then bears fruit when we are sent back to our vocations and our families, our work, and our culture. Right now, a lot of the stuff I'm sharing with you is from an article by a guy named Gene Veith, who wrote a really good book on vocation, right, Brett? You know, what was the name of that again?
God at Work.
God at Work, which would be recommended reading, you know, for if you want to think more about this. That's a good one. I'll share another one with you in a second. But for Luther, again, in the Protestant Reformation, you know, our callings, our work, our vocation, it's not first of all about what we do. This is what's really interesting. Rather, it's about what God does through us. You know, God gives, you know, we always pray, God, give us our daily bread, right? That's part of the Lord's Prayer. Well, how does God answer that prayer most of the time? He doesn't drop a basket from heaven onto your dinner table. He gives you your daily bread through the vocation of farmers, of factory workers, of bakers, and the truck drivers and the grocery store employees, right? I mean, all of that are you know, its work, it's a vocation that God uses to answer that prayer for us. The hands that prepared our meal and so on. God creates and cares for new life by means of vocations of mother and father, of husband and wife. He protects us. We pray for God to protect us. Again, he normally doesn't drop some invisible spiritual shield around us. He protects us by means of police officers and judges, the military, and other types of Romans 13 vocations, those who bear the sword. God brings healing. Now, of course, we believe that God still works miracles and can, and we often pray, but most of the time, God brings healing not through direct miraculous intervention, but through the vocations of doctors and nurses and hospital staff and pharmacists and other types of medical callings. God teaches us through teachers. He conveys his word through preachers. He gives the blessing of technology through engineers and creates beauty through artists. God works through all of these people who do things for us day by day, and he also works through us in whatever tasks, offices, and relationships he has called us to do. So you can see just that's just a radically different way of thinking about our work than a Roman Catholic view, at least the medieval Roman Catholic view. And it restores the dignity and the spirituality to whatever it is God calls us to do. If it's being a mom, stay-at-home mom full-time, that's not somehow less spiritual than being the pastor of the church and writing sermons during your week and teaching people, because it's just a different calling. It's just a different vocation. And God is very, it's a very high calling to care and nurture children the same way as. So you think this way, no matter what we do, there's a spiritual significance to it. It is a way that we offer ourselves to God and give him spiritual service, as Paul says. We offer our bodies to do that. So it charges our work with more significance and gives us a powerful motivation to perform everything we do with excellence, even if it seems menial or less significant or not as important as others. You could hear the way Luther thinks about it. Our vocation is a way we love our neighbors as ourselves, right? By doing the job that we do, we're offering a service that needs to be done for this, towns to be able to live together, communities to be able to form. We're all contributing to that in some way through our vocation. Regardless of what it is, you can think that way about it. So the bottom line is, again, we could spend a lot more time on this, but what we think of as secular work is as valuable and God-honoring, again, as I said, as the Christian ministry on a Protestant understanding of work. There's nothing more inherently spiritual about working in parachurch or church ministry than there is about being a baker, a candlestick maker, or a butcher. Sorry, butcher. Baker, butcher, candlestick. Butcher, baker, candlestick maker. I botched that one. All right. The Christian ministry is a calling of God, so is being a mother. Both of them are spiritually charged and very significant. When we use our gifts in work, whether by making clothes, building machines, or software, practicing law, tilling the fields, mending broken bodies, we're answering God's call to serve the human community. Our work greatly matters to God. This is the Protestant understanding of work, of vocation. Now, it's very important. Let me say a few more things about this, and we'll pause to see if there's any discussion. It's very important to understand this. I mean, this was a revolutionary idea at the time of the Reformation, and it's very easy to slip back into more of a Roman Catholic mindset on this. And I think to a large degree, unless we consciously remind ourselves, we will. I think it is a something in the American church that we kind of form what many writers have called a new monasticism. And the idea there is, we really do, despite what we've just said, we just kind of assume that religious callings are just more important to God. Those who spend their time in the church or missionaries on the field or parachurch ministry, whatever. If you're working 24/7 in the ministry, that's obviously has more value, right? That's more important to God. I mean, I think that's our mindset will naturally go there unless we remind ourselves that that's actually not true. One writer I came across put it this way: You know, in American Christianity, we often give the impression that religious work is more God-pleasing than other tasks and duties associated with the world. According to this mindset, the believer who makes an evangelism call, or who serves on a congregational committee, or who reads a lesson in church service, is performing a more spiritually significant work than the Christian mother who tends her children, or the Christian who works with integrity in a factory. You know, it's interesting. Over a couple of years now, I've had several people say something of this effect to me. It's usually an off comment, and sometimes it's half jokingly, but I can tell it's also half serious. Where it's clear that people seem to assume that because I'm a pastor, the work I do is somehow more spiritually significant, or more, it matters more to God, or something of that nature. I had a guy say to me this several years ago, and again, half joking, but as you say, there's always, you know, partial truth in every joke. Something to the effect, I can't even remember the full conversation, but we were talking about something we need to pray for, and he said, "Well, you should pray because you're much closer to God than I am. You know, you're a pastor," which again is not, which is not really a Protestant way. It's not a biblical way of thinking about this. Yeah, it's kind of assuming there's like this gradation. You know, God's at the center of a bullseye, and if you're a factory worker, you're way on the outer ring. And then the more you do ministry, kind of the closer you get to God, and the more access you have. Well, that's foreign to what we would think the Bible teaches. The Bible says we're all priests. We all have access to God. And there's nothing about inherently being a minister which means you have somehow greater access or it's a more important calling. So I get comments like these. I've gotten them. I'm sure I'll continue to get them. And I just want to say that's not what we believe. That's not actually true. And the problem with that line of thinking, if we think, oh boy, you know, to do really important work, I need to do something that seems spiritual, something kingdom related, is that often we will bring that into our vocations and do a poor job at our vocations because we think we have to spiritualize them in some way. And I think that there are Christians out there, and I would tell you, I wish someone had talked to me about this, you know, years and years ago, in my last few years in the Coast Guard, because I felt that pressure. Instead, yeah, I felt like, boy, in order to legitimize and make the most of my calling as a junior officer, I've got to try to share the gospel as much as possible on the job and find time anytime I can to read my, you know, just anything to legitimize it, right? Just kind of squeeze some spiritual stuff into there. And that's just not true. You don't have to do that. Our work does not only have value to the extent that we can do kingdom work by sharing the gospel or praying for someone. Now, I'm not saying those are things we shouldn't be thinking about, and if we have opportunity to do that, of course. But that we don't need to do that to legitimize the callings that God has given us. I mean, they're legitimate and they're honoring to God as we carry them out the way we do it. And again, to quote this guy Veith, this is a good line. He said, "It may seem strange to us to think that such mundane activities as spending time with your spouse and children, going to work, and taking part in your community are part of your holy calling, and that the daily grind can be a spiritual sacrifice." But he says, "It's not as strange, though, as what currently," this is very insightful, "as what currently tears many Christians apart. A spiritual life that has little to do with families, their work, or their cultural life. Many Christians treat other people horribly, including their spouses and children, while cultivating their own personal piety. Many well-intentioned Christians lose themselves in church work and church activities while neglecting their marriages, their children, and their other callings." See, that's the problem if we lose this idea of vocation. Back in when we lived in California, there was this program that I would go to. I wasn't the counselor, but it was for seminary students like me. There was a biblical counseling institute there. And it was a great program. If you're a seminary student, you could go and you could sit in on the counseling. There were two certified guys that would counsel. It was free counseling, open to the community. It was mainly Christians that came through, but it didn't have to be. But part of it being free is that the people being counseled had to agree, look, we're training men for the ministry. So there may be a guy or girl in there They're not going to say anything. They're just observing. You know, everything's confidential. They had agreed to do that, and they could go for free if they did. Great opportunity for people like me, because I got to sit in on hours and hours and hours of various different types of kind of counseling and just listen and try to learn. And there was this one couple that came in, and probably 80% of the counseling cases that I saw come in were marriage problems. Yeah, these are Christians. It was marriage-related issues. And this couple was having, you know, difficulties. Their marriage was starting to... it wasn't a crisis. You know, some people come in, it's way too late. It wasn't that far along, but there were some issues there. And as it turns out, there's probably 6 or 7 sessions that I observed with this. One of the main things driving the problem is this guy was a passionate evangelist, which is good. And he led the evangelism team. Their church had an evangelism team that went out on the weekends, sometimes at nights, to go hit the streets, literally hit the streets and try to evangelize and go to these various places. And he was passionate about this. This was his calling. This was his ministry. This was the work of God that he was doing. The problem was he was never at home. And they had 5 young kids. And he was gone so much doing the work of ministry that ironically his marriage was falling apart. And part of what this counselor helped this guy see was, you know, you don't have to, I mean, we all have seasons of life and calling. It's, you know, it's good to have this desire to go out and evangelize. That's, and your boldness is commendable. But this guy was thinking that in order to kind of legitimize his life, he needed to do that, right? Because this is where the spiritual work is. Being at home with my kids and changing the diapers and helping clean up the dishes. That's not doing, you know, that's somehow inferior to going out and sharing the gospel. And of course, the irony is he was about, you know, if he had kept on this way, he would have lost his marriage and his kids and disqualified himself from ministry in the future for doing that. But you know, there's that tension that can come when you view that religious work as somehow more important or more spiritual than being a father, a husband, a mother, or just an employee somewhere. And so we talked to this guy about the doctrine of vocation. You know, God calls you to be a father, and he's calling you to be a husband, and your desire to do this is good, but this is important too, and this is God honoring too. And you have to balance those things. So, anyway... that's all by way of introduction, but these are very important ideas. Any thoughts, anything you want to talk about before we press on this, Kathy?
Earlier on, a little while ago, I actually just started crying because you reminded me of something that happened this week, that I had a woman come in, and I know her. I've gotten to know her through the library, and we'll talk about faith. She's a woman of faith, too. But she came in, and I'm like, how are you today? I need a hug. I went out from around the counter and hugged her. Not only is her cancer not in remission, but she needs 2 cataract surgeries that they scheduled immediately from her chemo. It's like kicked it into, and you know, I mean, it's a public library, but I know this about her, and I know that she believes and she knows I do, and she felt she could come to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just a librarian, but it pretty much goes with everything you say.
Right. Any other questions, comments? Well, if not, we'll charge on.
Just in a nutshell, Gloria? In the years that Fred and I have been married, there were times when I would just pray, Lord, change me or change the circumstances. We did both.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Good. Okay. Well, let's start to get really practical. And those are kind of two broad but very important ways that our faith informs our work. Really, we need that perspective before we can kind of go to the nitty gritty. But very practically, then, you know, the gospel in my work. How does it shape it? How does it change it? I'll recommend to you, this is not a difficult read. It's very easy, pretty short. It's called The Gospel at Work. Some of the stuff is just, it's just a very practical book. If you're looking for a short, quick read, you can read something like this. This is by Greg Gilbert and Sebastian Traeger. And also reference some stuff out of Tim Keller's Center Church book, which is good. But, yeah, you know, so how does our faith inform our work? And one of the most helpful concepts in this book, which kind of goes throughout the whole book, is that there's two wrong ways. You know, as Christians, there's two wrong ways to think about work. Or there's two pitfalls we have to avoid. You know, that our faith should help us avoid, basically. One is, it's a helpful way of thinking it. One is that our faith should keep our work from becoming an idol, if you know what I mean by that. In other words, you know, an idol is not just, you know, the statue that we worship, but anything that becomes what's most important to us. The most important thing in our life, you know, is something that we worship. Actually, we'll talk about this a little bit in the sermon today. But it's very possible, and we know this is true just from the culture we live in, for our work, the thing that we do, even if that's being a mother or a father or, you know, not maybe something that we don't normally think of as work, but it is a lot of work. It's very possible that our work becomes the primary object of our passions, our energy, and our love. And if that happens, it's become an idol, right? It's become something that we look to find meaning and purpose and significance in our life. But we end up worshiping our job, basically, and that's what gives us meaning. That's what gives us identity. Let me see if I was going to comment on something to say about this. So this is one way that our faith, you know, comes into our work. I don't want to say any more about this. Yeah, they say the trouble starts when it's not that we shouldn't like our jobs or even love our jobs or enjoy the opportunity. You know, we saw work is good. It's part of our image of God to want to produce and that type of thing. So work, it's not that we shouldn't enjoy or love our jobs. The trouble starts, they say, when our pursuit of our work begins to make our work the source of ultimate satisfaction or meaning for us. When that happens, our work has become our God. So that's one thing, and they give this, again, this is a very practical book. They give some signs, you know, what are some indications that that actually might be happening to you, that your work is becoming just too important. Not that work is not important, but you're veering on the one hand towards idolatry. And they say a couple things, which I'll just mention in passing. One, you know, your work is your primary source of your satisfaction. And they say it's all too easy to look for fulfillment from your work, finding your ultimate purpose and job performance and success. For some, this kind of idolatry takes the subtle form of insisting that we'll only do what we were made to do and refusing to do or do well anything less than what we're passionate about. For others, this can take the form of a constant grinding frustration, a sense that their work is not completely fulfilling. And they say, what about you? Does your success at work fill a big need in your life? Do you find your mood radically shifting as your professional stock goes up and down? And of course, you know, part of the reason this is a problem is that our jobs can never provide the kind of satisfaction we want, even if our stock keeps going up and up. It'll never actually satisfy. And they go on here again. If you want to read, I'm not going to. We're trying to get through, you know, this in 2 weeks, so can't spend too much time here. So that's one problem. That's one way our faith informs our work. It should keep our work from being an idol. The gospel reminds us that only God can really function as the center of our life. And if we find our identity in our work, it's bound to cause lots of problems that will manifest itself in our life, including personal unhappiness and frustration if our work becomes too important. Now, the other pitfall that the gospel helps us avoid is not just making our work an idol, but being idle in our work. So that's, again, the other takeaway from this book. The other, you know, ways that we dishonor God or that our faith should inform our work is keep us from being lazy in it. Keep us from thinking that it's unimportant. And of course, part of the reason why is what we just talked about, is that our vocation, it's not something that's unimportant. And the only thing that's important that I do is what I do for the church. our vocation is something that God has given us and called us to do, to be a reflection of love for neighbor and make the world a better place to live and all those types of things. So there's significance there. Understanding that should keep us from being idle in our work or failing to see God's purpose in it. And of course, then they go in and give signs for that as well. And then they make the point, and this is so true, unfortunately, both making work an idol and being idle in our work are celebrated in our society, right? We look to, you know, the people that have, you know, advanced their career by sacrificing everything else and say, well, that's what I want to be. That's what it means to be a success. That's how you got to make millions of dollars. You got to go for it. You got to give up everything. And we celebrate that kind of life. We also, in a way, celebrate those who, you know, only live for the weekend, you know, which is a phrase that, you know, we use a lot when I was at the Coast Guard. You know, we're just getting through the grind so we can live for the weekend, man. You know, just, I don't really care about what I do. I don't really want to invest in it. I just want to get to the weekend. I just want to relax. And both, you know, that kind of attitude, we see that in commercials all of the time, right? It's celebrated, right? To kind of view our work as trivial, something that, you know, we can be lazy in, those types of things. Okay, so there's negatively, real quick, we'll take 3 minutes here because we can finish this subject and go on to something else next week. Well, we don't have to do that. Are there any thoughts? We can. I mean, it's not like we're in a rush. Anyone want to talk about either of those two? Maggie?
What I've always found helpful is Colossians 3:23. It says, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men.
Yep, thank you. Yeah, there is actually, I mean, that's just where I was going to go, Maggie. Thank you. There is actually some, you know, biblical material that talks about how our faith should shape our work. Colossians 3, 22-24 is one of the primary passages, which is what Maggie just said, right? Slaves, obey and everything. Those are your earthly masters. Not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. And of course, we don't have time to get into this discussion, but the nearest equivalent today of what, you know, the term slaves there or bond servants is would be an employee to employer type relationship. I mean, it's probably, you know, it's certainly not an exact equivalent, but I think the principles would be applicable. Obey at everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men. So our callings, the work we do, you know, we're called there by God. And so we're to see really Him as our, you know, as who we're working for, knowing that from the Lord you'll receive the inheritance as your reward. And I'll finish here with this. Just a couple other ways here. This is, again, this is Keller's book, Center Church, but he's got a helpful section here on just being a Christian in the culture and talks about some of the things we've already said, how the gospel does shape our work. It must shape our work. We can't be a Christian on Sunday and have that not take that into what we're called to do throughout the week. I mean, that's a real problem. But what does that look like? And he says, well, one, our faith changes the motivation for our work, right? And you could hear it in that Colossians 3 passage. Why are we working? Why are we doing, even if it's not a job that we find the deepest meaning and satisfaction is, maybe it's not what we thought we were doing. You know, why are we doing it? And who are we doing it for? We're doing it ultimately for the Lord was what Paul says. We should think of it that way because he's the one that's put us there. And that charges the work. It gives it a new significance and a new motivation. Keller says, for professionals and others who are prone to overwork and anxiety, the gospel prevents us from finding our significance and identity in money and success. For working class people who are prone to captivation to what Paul calls eye service, our faith directs us to work with all our heart as working for the Lord. So it changes our motivation. Our faith changes our conception of work. Keller puts it that way. And again, we've already kind of touched on that. Keller says, understanding that work was designed in creation helps us to see that even simple tasks such as making a shoe, filling a tooth, and digging a ditch are ways to serve God and build up human community. Our cultural production rearranges the material in such a way that honors God and promotes human flourishing. A good theology of work resists the modern world's tendency to value only expertise in the pursuit in the pursuits that command more money and power. In other words, you know, our culture is all about choose the vocation and the career that will get you the most money. That's what you need to do. There's studies actually showing that that's what youth are doing. What do you want to be when you grow up? Well, I want to be a doctor. Why? Well, because you can get rich doing that. I mean, it's kind of, unfortunately, a lot of people are choosing their career path based on where's the prestige, who's most respected, where can I get money? But, you know, that's not a godly way of looking at it. Everything we do has value and is part. I mean, if everyone was a doctor, boy, this society would be in trouble, right? Because we'd have no one to actually take our garbage out of our homes and move it. I mean, think of how important that is for living in community. I mean, just that job, which we think of, oh, yeah, I'm a garbage man or I'm a whatever, has a vital role to play. So our faith changes our motivation, our faith changes our conception, our faith provides high ethics for Christians in the workplace. And of course, we haven't really addressed this, but our Christian faith should inform it doesn't mean we have to spiritualize our job by becoming evangelists on the job, but it should change the way we carry out our work, right? We shouldn't buy into the cutthroat competitive culture. We shouldn't feel okay about lying and cheating on the job and then coming to church on Sunday. It should, you know, we have to bring the calling of Christ and our character into whatever job that we do. Keller puts it this way: many things are technically legal, but biblically immoral and unwise, and therefore out of bounds for believers. The ethical norms of the Christian life, grounded in the gospel of grace, should always lead believers to function with an extremely high level of integrity in their work. We can't say more about that. And then finally, just to finish this up, our faith changes our motivation, our conception, gives us high ethics. And finally, our faith gives us the basis for reconceiving the very way in which our kind of work is done. And he says, every community works on the basis of a collective map of what is considered most important. And he goes on here. Basically, it's what we've already stated, that it's not just high-profile jobs that are important. Every type of job is important. So that's all I got. Final thoughts? Jenny?
I found in my own experience that it's not just the job that I have to go